Hey everyone, welcome to the 11th episode of the NISA podcast, The Unmentionables. I'm Mia Clark, co-founder of NISA, a new women's wellbeing company dedicated to supporting parents through their fourth trimester recovery journeys. In each episode, we interview either an expert working in the field or we share parents' first-hand stories and uncover some of those unmentionables that many of us experience postpartum but don't necessarily talk about. This is a place for us to share information, resources, and real stories so we can help shine a light on what really goes down. Because we can promise you that whatever shape your fourth trimester experience takes, you're not alone. So this is the final episode of season one of The Unmentionables. Thank you so much to everyone who's been listening since we started back in May. And of course, to all the amazing guest experts that we've been fortunate enough to speak to over the last few months. That's included an economist, a doula, a pelvic floor therapist, a clinical psychologist, and many more wonderful women and men. The Unmentionables is a real labor of love for us. So if you've enjoyed any of these episodes, we'd be so grateful if you could please leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. A reminder too that you can still use the code podcast to get 10% off of your order of our fourth wear postpartum underwear for the rest of November. So just head on over to nisacare.com. Okay, I'm so looking forward to sharing this guest with you today. She has a lot of very important insights to share with us about what life is like for women and mothers who are incarcerated. Miyoshi Benton is a senior associate at the Women and Justice Project, which works to advance the leadership and build the power of currently and formerly incarcerated women. Miyoshi was a leader in the successful campaign to pass New York's 2015 anti-shackling law, which strengthened and expanded the ban on the barbaric practice of shackling incarcerated pregnant women. Miyoshi lives in Long Island City with her two children, and she's currently pursuing her bachelor's in communications.
Thank you, Mia, for having me. Super honored to be able to share some of my personal experience, but then also really the reality of what women on the inside face when it comes to being pregnant while incarcerated, but also what incarceration looks like overall. So regardless if you're pregnant or not, the same kind of conditions, the same kind of treatment applies to everyone. So first, as you mentioned, my name is Miyoshi, and I am a senior associate at the Women and Justice Project. And our mission is to advance the leadership and build the power of formerly incarcerated women to transform the criminal justice system. And before I came to the Women and Justice Project, I served 4 years inside of prisons in three different states, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. And my first contact into the criminal justice system, I was a month and a half pregnant at 19 years old. I went inside and I wasn't aware at the time that I was pregnant. So my first, I guess, news of being pregnant was when I took a pregnancy test inside of Orange County Correctional Facility in upstate New York. And that's when they told me that I was pregnant. And at the time, I already had a one-year-old at home, and I was now pregnant with another child. And so when we're thinking about the treatment of people on the inside, of women on the inside, we have to take into account that the criminal justice system is ran on a lot of punishment and control, safety, wellness, accountability, healing is not what part of the culture of the prison system, of any criminal justice system. Transparency, accountability, healing is not part of that culture. So with that in mind, when it came to food, the food was absolutely horrendous. You had meals where the meat was gray. You had meals where meat was not even cooked all the way. The pregnancy snack that they gave us on the inside was a bologna sandwich, something that doctors advise women on the outside not to have while pregnant, yet that was our pregnancy snack at the end of every night. The conditions of the weather in the inside, well, it was sometimes, you know, too hot or way too cold. The mattress that you slept on was so thin, and it was laying on a slab of metal. So to be able to really be comfortable in a bed is unheard of. Like, I struggled with problems of being able to push myself up because my daughter at the time was on my sciatic nerve, and it was hard for me to even move. And on top of the fact that there was not enough cushion in the mattress, it really debilitated me on a lot of in a lot of different ways. So the food was horrendous. The living conditions was unlivable. And the appointments to the doctors, you know when you're being treated differently. So I had my first child in the community at a regular doctor's office, a regular hospital. Inside, that's not the case. You're treated unfairly because you're incarcerated. So that's, everyone that's treating you and coming in contact with you are coming from a place of you're disposable, you should not be pregnant, you should not have kids because you're incarcerated. So the treatment that you receive is really poor treatment. I personally suffered from a very simple urinary tract infection in the beginning of my pregnancy, and they prescribed me antibiotics. And when I came back for my follow-up visit, I knew that I still had a urinary tract infection because I know my body enough, but as someone that was incarcerated, as a woman of color, like, they do not listen to us when we say there's something wrong with our bodies. So I said, I know I still have this urinary tract infection. They said, no, you don't. So they left it alone. They ignored me. And for that whole time during my pregnancy, I had that same urinary tract infection. And I can get into it later on about the complications that I experienced due to having a urinary tract infection for pretty much my whole pregnancy. But these are just very specific issues on how something so simple can be overlooked and ignored because of the condition of where I'm at. Because I'm inside of a jail, I'm inside of a prison. They don't really tell you much. I'm super grateful that I was one of those that really had some kind of understanding around pregnancy, because if I did not, I would have been extremely lost.
Miyoshi and I talked about the food and lack of it that she was provided with at Benton Hills during her pregnancy. Prisons leave much to be desired in facilitating safe and healthy pregnancies. The recommended diet during pregnancy includes 3 or more servings of fresh fruits, vegetables, dairy, and protein each day, as well as several servings of whole grains. These are vital nutrients for any pregnant woman, yet they're missing from most prison meal trays.
I could not eat any of the food. It was not even possible for me to even force myself to eat any of the food. So I did, for my outside doctor visit, I did bring it up to my doctor because I believe I was 5 months pregnant and my stomach was sunken in. Like, I literally lost weight from the time I went inside to my 5 month checkup. I literally had lost so much weight that I was 120 pounds. I went in around 135 because 135 is my average type of weight. By 5 months, I was 120 pounds. My stomach was sunken in. I wasn't eating. I was very weak because I wasn't getting any nutrients for myself, and I definitely wasn't getting any to pass on to my child. And I brought it up to the doctor, and I'm like, you know, I see that other women, and it wasn't pregnant women, but it was women on the inside who I was inside with, were getting Boost and, like, Ensure kind of drinks because they were suffering from withdrawals from heroin. And I seen that, so I'm like, all right, if they can, you know, get some kind of nutrients put into their system because of what they're going through, then as someone that is pregnant, I should be able to. And of course, you need a doctor's note saying that you can. So when I brought it up to my doctor, they just pretty much ignored me and refused to give me the Ensure that I needed to actually give myself the kind of nutrients that not only that I need, but my baby needed. And I just could not understand how, as a professional, as someone has sworn to really do by their patients in the right way, can treat me and my baby so poorly because I was incarcerated.
Yeah, that's absolutely shocking. I'm so sorry that you went through that. It's unbelievable. And the women that, you know, are going through this all the time. And you were also shackled during pregnancy and postpartum. Can you explain exactly, you know, what happens when somebody is shackled and what your experience of being shackled was like? How far along were you in your pregnancy? And you know, when it happened postpartum, how did that affect how you were able to take care of your daughter?
Right. So shackling anyone is standard policy and procedure in most places. We're super fortunate enough to have had a law that was in 2009 to ban the shackling of pregnant women during labor, delivery, and recovery. And that law only protected for that very small slice of time. And so for me, my first time being shackled, and shackling means that you have a waist chain that is connected to your handcuffs through a black box so that you cannot move your upper body from your waist and your wrists that are shackled. And then you also get ankle shackles. So usually when they do that, that's the standard procedure of shackling anyone.
Okay.
So my first time being shackled, I was definitely a couple months, probably 3 months, maybe a little bit before that, and I had to go to my court date. And so they shackled me, and I was shackled for a good between 10 and 12 hours. And they made the waist chain, they made it so tight that, like, I was in excruciating pain the whole day. And I just kept thinking to myself, like, I understand I made bad choices to end up in prison, but what I don't understand is how that my punishment is prison. After everything else after that is just inhumane and barbaric. And that's what was happening. I was suffering for hours. I was suffering for hours. No one cared to even loosen it. I wasn't even asking them to take it off, but I was asking for it to be loosened enough so that I can breathe. And that wasn't, of course, no one listened, no one cared enough to make sure that I wasn't, you know, in danger, or that my unborn child wasn't in danger. That wasn't a concern of theirs, because once again, it's about punishment and control, and safety is not a concern, even though they tend to say safety is. So I experienced being shackled throughout my pregnancy, all the way up until right after I gave birth to my daughter. I was then shackled and handcuffed in order to see her. So in New York State, Bethel Hills Correctional Facility, they have a nursery program that you can stay up with your child up until a year unless you go home within 18 months, and then you can keep your child with you up until 18 months. And it's a process of being able to get inside for them to figure out whether or not you can get into the nursery, and it's extremely hard. And over the years, it's been harder because of the different restrictions or stipulations and criteria that they put on people being able to get into the nursery. But I was fortunate enough to be able to get into the nursery. And before I went to the nursery, I was still in the hospital, just gave birth to my daughter. So Bethel Hills Correctional Facility has a partnership with Westchester Medical Center. So inside of Westchester Medical Center, they have a prison ward where anyone, I guess, that gets sick who's within the contract goes there. So that's women and men. So I was brought to the prison ward part of the hospital after giving birth to my daughter, and my daughter stayed at the nursery. Two totally different kinds of places. The nursery, of course, where they would keep regular people that are not incarcerated, was really bright, cheery. Everyone was like very concerned, pleasant. Anything that I needed, they was there. And I was there in the nursery with my daughter Serenity in the beginning, probably like the first 8 hours. And then because they didn't have any room in a prison ward, so then when they was able to get room in a prison ward, they then transferred me there. And once I got to the prison ward was a very dark, gloomy type of place, lights flickering, bars on the window, the broken window. The staff, the nurses was extremely rude and disrespectful. The whole culture and the ambiance of the hospital changed drastically. And then it became worse because now my concerns of just regular concerns after having a baby was ignored even more so than it would have if I would have stayed in the nursery. I didn't get to take showers. I didn't even get to take a shower out, like, or even like a
Oh my
little sitz
goodness.
bath. I didn't have access to a bathroom because, in order for you to be able to use the bathroom, because the prison ward shares space with men and women, it was very hard to be able to move around without being exposed to the sick men that were in the prison ward too.
So you only really had that time, that few hours to like to be with your daughter, to have that skin to skin time, or to breastfeed, if that was something you were thinking of. Like, how did that
Right.
work for you?
And speaking of breastfeeding, it was a lot of, when I think about all the ways that they took away rights that were still mine, no matter where I was incarcerated or where I was located, it's really heartbreaking. My baby stayed in the nursery. I stayed in the prison ward, and if an officer felt like it, they can take you to the nursery where your child is. The only problem with that is you have to be shackled and handcuffed, and then put in a wheelchair and brought to your child. And no one, honestly, the officers did not want to go through that kind of process because in their eyes, it's more work for them. So I was able to get a visit once when I was my 2 days of recovery inside the hospital to go see my child. And I was shackled and handcuffed the whole time. They only took the handcuffs off on one hand, one wrist, and I had to hold my child like that. I couldn't get up and walk with my child because I still had the ankle shackles on. And once again, that was in violation of the 2009 law. So that law protected me at that moment, and yet they still violated my rights.
Right.
Now, around breastfeeding, I knew that I wanted to breastfeed because I knew with my first child, he was super allergic to formula, like to the extreme.
Okay.
So I did not want to experience that again. And I knew that if I can breastfeed, that would eliminate a lot of problems of trying to figure out all the different six different milks that we went through before we was able to find a milk that worked for him.
Right.
And I made that very clear to them. I made it very clear to them that I wanted to breastfeed. And so I did breastfeed as soon as I first delivered her, I was able to breastfeed her. And then they brought me to the prison ward and I found out they was giving her bottles. But of course they was giving her bottles because they didn't allow me to breast pump or to directly feed her. And I was devastated by that because that was something that I really wanted to do. Like, regardless if she was allergic to the milk or not, like, I really wanted to be able to have that kind of bonding experience with my daughter. And they definitely took that away from me. And that was against the law because in New York State, it's a law to one, offer these services of support for women around breastfeeding. And they did not. They didn't offer. Even if I could not be directly with her, they could have offered me the breast pump in order to breast pump and then feed her the bottle, but they didn't
Right,
give me those
right.
options. They took those options away from me.
And do you happen to know, was that the case for other women who were also
Absolutely.
incarcerated at the time? It was just their practice. Unbelievable. And am I right in thinking, I think I read this in one of your interviews, that you, when you were giving birth to your daughter, you had there were male officers in the room with you.
Yeah, so when I was in labor, so one of the things about New York State is that you cannot have anyone with you while giving birth. Like, you have to do it alone unless, well, besides the officers that's in the room with you. And so I had the doctor and I had the officer in between my leg. Of course, the doctor is there to help me deliver my baby
Sure.
safely. And the officer was there to my disbelief. I have no idea why the officer felt like it was necessary to be so close, a male officer at that. I don't know what
Yeah,
his
that he'd
role,
be
who did he
standing
feel
next
like
to
he
the
was
doctor.
protecting exactly. And they did get into an argument. The doctor did feel a certain way. The doctor, and I remember very specifically, the doctor said, "Can she at least please have some dignity?" And I was so exhausted by the experience of having to even deal with the officer being there, intruding on such a very private moment,
Mm-hmm.
really wiped me out in a way where I could not even push no more. Like at one point I stopped pushing, and I stopped pushing because I gave up. I was like, you know what? Like, just get her out. Like, just get her out. But like, I don't have anything else in me anymore, anything to be able to push her out. And, you know, that was, you know, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking.
It is. And, you know, it's the giving birth is hard enough in, you know, in other circumstances, hard enough. Like, I can completely imagine how you're just so exhausted of trying to advocate for yourself constantly in a situation like that. It's, you know.
Right.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Well, after your release, you went back to school, right? And then you are now senior associate at the Women and Justice Project, which is amazing. And you were a leader in a very successful campaign to see that New York 2015 anti-shackling law passed, which is one of the most progressive laws of its kind that's in the country. So could you tell us exactly about what that law is and how it has gone on to protect those who are incarcerated in New York State?
Absolutely. So before I jump into 2015, I think it'd be super helpful that the 2009 law was in place, as I mentioned to you, and that law was very... So what happened was after the 2009 law was passed, there's an organization that was able to go inside of prisons and monitor the conditions of just all the prisons in New York State. And when they monitored the conditions of Bethel Hill Correctional Facility, what they had noticed was that after the 2009 law, 23 out of the 27 women that they interviewed was illegally shackled.
Wow.
So what that did was made it very clear that not only was these laws not expansive enough, but it also, this law was still being violated by the Department of Corrections. So I came home and I got involved with my supervisors, Jai and Tamar, who are amazing. And they came, I was at Our Children, which is a nonprofit organization that reunites mothers and children after incarceration. And they came to Our Children and they said, you know, has anyone been shackled while pregnant on the inside? And I thought, wow, yes, I have. So then we had a conversation, and then one, it made it very clear to me what rights of mine was violated back when I was pregnant on the inside. But also that because this was still happening, that I needed to be involved so that we can do our best to make sure no other woman in New York State would be subjected to such inhumane conditions. So the 2015 anti-shackling law was to strengthen the 2009 law, but to also expand it. So it expanded to from the moment you know that you're pregnant, you are now protected and you're not supposed to be shackled, handcuffed, or anything. And of course, there's like an exception to that in extreme cases, but very small exception. And then it also protected you 8 weeks postpartum. So you can't be shackled and handcuffed 8 weeks postpartum after. And then it gave the woman the right to be able to decide whether or not they wanted an officer in the room. We also put that in the bill because we knew from my personal experience that one, we didn't want to take the right away from any woman to have an officer in the room because that's the only person in New York State that can be in the room with you. So we didn't want, just in case there is an officer that is compassionate, that does offer some kind of comfort to the woman, we didn't want to take that away from them. So we left it where it was up to the discretion of the woman that is pregnant to decide whether or not they want the officer in the room. We also put into the bill, absolutely, which is really important, but we put into the bill around officers and staff being trained to not shackle women, which it's a little bizarre to me that you have to have a training to not shackle someone, but that's, unfortunately, that's exactly what needed to be said and put into the bill because there's a lot of opposition towards the fact that it was going to be more work as if shackling someone or not shackling, like not shackling someone would be even more work. It's actually less. But okay, we also had into the bill that every woman that's coming inside of the criminal justice system know of this right. So even if they're not pregnant, everyone is aware of these rights, and these rights are put in places, in medical places, so that people can read and have access to the information. So this law went and became, well, this bill became a law immediately. And it was amazing, because we knew that it would be even harder to violate it the way the 2009 law was violated. Now,
I
cannot speak 100% sure, because when it comes to the Department of Corrections, the problem is there's no accountability and oversight. And when there's no accountability and oversight, it's hard to know what's really going on unless someone is reaching out. So we haven't really heard many cases since since the beginning of 2016 around women being illegally shackled, but we can't confirm nor deny whether or not it's happened.
Obviously, this was a huge win for women who are incarcerated in New York State, and you know, this is where you're living and working, and your research is working. Your work is rooted here. But what do you know about what's going on in other states, both in terms of shackling laws and how women and mothers are treated differently?
So, so recently, well, maybe in the past couple of years, we came together with other. So what happened was I got a part of a conference where it was formerly incarcerated women, mothers who experienced shackling that had shackling laws inside of their states, came together with women, formerly incarcerated women in other states that wanted to have anti-shackling laws in place. And what we did was we pretty much brainstormed and shared what we have done and what we have learned and our strategies that we use, because we knew that there was many states that did not have any kind of anti-shackling laws on the books. So as of right now, there's 26 states that have some form of anti-shackling laws. But that does not mean to what extent it protects the woman, because it could be anti-shackling laws where there's no shackling of the waist chain, but you can still use handcuffs. So it really depends on the state, but our job was to make sure that we can share as much as we can in order to help other women in other states make it a possibility to get a even more progressive law. Because when we did this back in 2015, our law was the most progressive one out there. But what we also wanted the other states that did not have any anti-shackling laws in place was for them to even push it further, not to do what we did, but to do even more and to put a lot more in place. Because, you know, there's a lot of states that, you know, in New York, we would have loved to be able to take advantage of doulas and midwives. But we put in the bill what we could, and we did as much as we could in order to protect the women and give them as much kind of comfort as possible. But now we know that, you know, we made this mark, what can we do now to even further the experience? And honestly, what it boils down to is to stop incarcerating women. But since we're not there yet, we're still trying to figure out every kind of support that women need in order to have a successful pregnancy as possible while on the inside. So there's states like Oklahoma, I believe, who was one of the last ones to be able to get a law. And that law was put into place in 2018 after our convening that we did 2 years ago. And, you know, she was able to put into the bill around, you know, having doula support. So there's states out there that is really, really being mindful of all the other ways that women need support and trying to really put these into bills so that these laws could get passed.
That's amazing. So you do feel, I mean, obviously there is a huge, huge way to go, but you do feel that you can see momentum happening like across the country in this space.
I do. I think, you know, momentum is happening, but because there's so much going on in this country right now, it's like I feel like momentum is happening, but now it's so many other problems to be tackling that it's not happening as fast as it could or should be, but it's definitely happening.
So the big question I have here is, like, how can the larger community help, and what kind of advocacy work is most effective in this space, and how would you recommend, you know, people start engaging to create change in people who aren't, you know, working at a policy level or, you know, in the birth community, just regular people? Like, what can we do to help?
So when talking about what people can do to help, before we even give some kind of action task for people to get involved, we think it's super important for people to get educated, right? And whether that's educated around language, which is a really big one. So words like inmate, ex-con, felon, you know, these kind of dehumanizing words, we ask people to, like, educate themselves on the fact that, like, to move away from that language. Because that language allows society to disassociate from what is actually happening to that individual on the inside, because it allows people to see that person as less than a human being. So when things are happening, it's not much outrage because we're using words as inmate or convent or felon, opposed to using words as mother or sister, you know, humanizing language.
Yeah. You know, I really appreciate that because, you know, when we were communicating before this podcast, I used the term inmate, and, you know, you very rightly corrected me. And I think, again, that's one of those things that, you know, language is so important. And, you know, even though I try to be very mindful of the language I use, I didn't realize that that was, you know, the humanizing term to use. So I think it is so important to educate and get people, you know, using the correct language that's helpful.
Right. And it's, you know, language is powerful, right? Because language has always been used to either spur people into action or to keep people stagnated or unaware of actually the severity of situations. So that's why. And also it feels, honestly, you know, when we hear these kind of dehumanizing terms, it feels like a physical blow. Like, I personally feel like it's a physical blow when I hear it, because it doesn't speak to, like, who I am and how I show up in the world. So to be reduced to something that it's one part of my life just feels like it's unfair as to who I am and how I choose to show up. The other ways for people to get involved is that once you get a little more educated around language and around what it looks like for women inside of prisons or in those are incarcerated, then you can start being able to, one, share the information. But what is important is to get involved with grassroots organizations that are in each person's area, because it's the work that needs to be done is really in the communities, and it's not on a national level, even though these are national problems that we face. These are very local situations that can be handled. And if people plug into the grassroots organizations that are doing the work, they can then be able to educate themselves a little more and then understand where they fit into the ecology of this movement, right? Because there's a role for everyone. And I feel like sometimes when people want to get involved, they're not really too sure what their role is. And when we're talking about roles in this movement, it's super important to recognize that we feel like formerly incarcerated or directly impacted individuals, whether it's women or men, should be at the forefront of transforming the criminal justice system and the forces that drive that. And we also believe that we have to do that in partnership with our allies of those that are not, you know, formerly incarcerated, or those that have no experience with incarceration, but really have really feel morally obligated to do something about what our country, the state of our country is in. Because, you know, we do have 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world incarcerated population. And it's even more staggering when we're talking about it for women, because it's 5% of the women's on the world's the women's population, but it's 33% of the world's incarcerated women population. So we know that because women are the fastest growing population, that things need to be done. And when we're taking women out of households, that means we're leaving so many children without a parent, because most of the mothers are sole providers of of these children.
Yeah, and 80%. I read in your, you know, in your report that 80% of the women in prison are mothers. Every time a mother is incarcerated, you're essentially incarcerating the whole family. I mean, it has a much bigger ripple effect.
Absolutely,
than just the mother. Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you. That's really helpful. And so also we asked our Instagram community what questions they had for you. We just wanted to share a couple on here. So Grace asked, did your experiences advocating for yourself and others concerning shackling lead you to examine other areas where you could, should, or did advocate for your rights or the rights of your fellow women who were incarcerated?
Yeah, so when it comes to advocating, when you're formerly incarcerated, you have so many experiences that you can speak to that the list goes on forever. And it's very hard to really advocate for one confinement condition without really advocating for them all. And not saying that you experience them all, but 9 times out of 10, because of the culture of what prison is, you experience most of them. So I personally advocate around solitary confinement, advocate as someone that was pregnant on inside, that was shackled. I advocate for the abolishment of prisons in general, because we know that prisons are not geared towards accountability, transformation, and healing, and we need systems put in place to really address the root causes of why people go to jail, why women go to jail, which is social and economic reasons, issues, not criminal.
Yeah, great.
Did I answer that question?
You definitely did. You're so right. It's like everything's so deeply interconnected when you've been through that. That totally makes sense. And Mel is a yoga teacher, and she teaches prenatal and postnatal yoga at Cook County Jail, which is here in Chicago. And she was wondering if you're aware of any other yoga programs like that or comfort measures that are currently offered in New York facilities that you're aware of? Or, I know you mentioned, we were talking about doulas too, and actually this can kind of tie into this next question. Veronica, who's a birth and postpartum doula, she wants to know how doulas help. So, just other comfort measures, having doulas, having yoga, prenatal yoga teachers, things like that. Are you aware of how much that's happening?
So I'm aware of that happening on a very small scale, because being able to get into any kind of correctional facility is, and I hate calling it a correctional facility because it's not correcting anything, but any kind of legal system, it's extremely hard for people from the community to go in and help. So whether it's a yoga instructor or a doula, I know that it's happening. And the only place, honestly, that I heard of it happening is Rikers Island, where they have as horrific as that place is.
Right.
They do have limited access to doulas inside of Rikers Island, from my understanding. But, of course, it's extremely hard. They make it extremely difficult, not only for the woman that's incarcerated, but for the doulas that do come in and try to offer as much comfort to the woman as possible. Mm. So it's very minimum when it comes to having that kind of support in places in New York. Like, I know a few advocates are trying to figure out getting more clearance and more kind of access to these facilities in order to increase doulas inside of these facilities. But it's been extremely difficult.
Well, Miyoshi, thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation and for all of the work that you're continuing to do in this space. It's so necessary, and we really appreciate your time.
I'd like to say a big thank you to Miyoshi and also to Alison Holohan at the Osborne Association in New York, who helped set up our interview. So if you're in Chicago, a couple of the organizations that NISA is involved with include Chicago Books to Women in Prison, which sends packages of donated books to incarcerated women across the country. We also support the Women's Justice Institute. And of course, if you'd like to read more about the Women and Justice Project, where Miyoshi works, you can head to womenandjusticeproject.org. And please, if you know of any organizations across the US that listeners can support at a grassroots level, please consider leaving us a note on our Instagram underneath the post for this episode. Thank you so much. So we like to end each episode by bringing NISA's co-founders, Eden and Aubrey, into the studio as well. So they're joining me now. And since it's the last episode of season one, and we're now a year into running NISA, we thought we'd share a little bit about what this last year has been like as we juggle work, motherhood, and more. So hi, guys.
Hi, Mia.
Hi, Mia. And congratulations
last
on the end of
episode.
The Yeah, season. It's been a wild ride.
Really great.
How do we feel?
Well, I think it's been a wild ride for all of us. It's been a bit of a crazy year. Starting a business, juggling a family.
Life.
Yeah. Eden, how has this last year struck you?
Adventurous. I feel like there are days that I can be dancing and then I can be crying all within the same day. That there are highs that feel like make me think, why was I upset yesterday? And then within hours, then I'm like, what am I doing? I have a notebook where I write down notes that who knows what will happen with them, but they're just about starting a business, right? And this is not our first business, but this one feels bigger. And there was a note I have in there maybe like 3 weeks ago, because I like looking back, and it says in all caps, why would you do this?
I feel like the irony is not lost on any of us that we started this business based on the shock and awe that we felt surrounding the experience of new motherhood, and we basically threw ourselves right back into the fire
with
the business.
Followed a baby together. Yeah.
So what would be your guys' answer to that? Like, why are you doing this?
I think that there's this feeling from the start, from the moment that the nurse handed me the mesh to even that week that I wrote, why would I, in a notebook, that it felt as if it is an obligation, as mothers, is an obligation of participants in society, as people who can think creatively, as people who can shape things with their hands, and that we had to. And I think a big part that I know that we've talked about, and that part of that shock was not just like, oh my God, what did my body go through? But also, I can't believe this is this year and there's not a product that really speaks, or there isn't language, or there isn't anything, that there isn't support systems or resources. And if we had not started NISA, I would feel like not only a missed opportunity, but also I failed some part of myself to make things better.
Mm-hmm. And I know that for me, sort of despite all of the trials and tribulations that can come with starting a new business and sleepless nights, when you're spending day after day doing something that you really believe in, it makes it worthwhile as much as it heightens the anxiety, because you really care about succeeding and about doing something that makes an impact in the way that you want to, you know, see it make an impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say for all of us, a really big motivator was just to make sure that this next wave of birthing parents has a more positive experience of postpartum recovery than we did.
And I think another incredible gift from this last year, from building the podcast and building this community, is also growing our network of other amazing women that are doing incredible things. And it feels like a movement, a strong movement. And to be a part of that and these collaborations that we're creating is absolutely incredible. And we're very excited about the next season of The Unmentionables, and already lining up some spectacular guests.
Yep, we'll be back early next year.
Yeah, so we look forward to talking with you all then.
Thanks to everyone for listening so much.
Go forth.
Okay, that's it for today and for the end of season one. To stay abreast of what NISA is up to, please follow us on Instagram at NISA Care, where we share stories and information about the unmentionables of the fourth trimester in parenthood. And sign up for our newsletter, NISA News, on our website. The NISA podcast is recorded at Strange Magic Recording, produced and edited by Robbie Haynes and Tony Lazara. The theme music is by Electrolane.